Good to be with you. My first guest today needs little introduction to you. Before we say hello to him, he's pulled over, by the way. He's pulled over. He's driving on the UK's national motorways today. And he's pulled over. Before that, Sky News is reporting this afternoon that the president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, has been briefing the media in his own country and has told them that Iran will boost its enrichment of uranium to, quote, whatever amount it feels like. He's repeated what he said at the weekend. Okay, Sky says this is a vital component for a nuclear bomb. The Iranians say they don't have any intention of making a nuclear bomb, but what they are doing is in response to fresh sanctions from the United States of America, announced last week by Donald Trump. This all goes back to Trump pulling the US out of the 2015 nuclear deal. Okay, Trump pulled the US out of it last year, and he also acted to bar all international sales of Iranian oil. I mentioned Tony already. He's the host of the politics show on BCFM in Bristol. He's much more besides as well. I won't drone on about his resume. Let's just welcome him back to the programme. Tony, thanks for coming on today. How are you doing?
All right, Richie. Thanks for calling again. Lovely always to have the pleasure of your company and your listeners.
You're a gent, mate. You're a top contributor. It's a great pleasure. It's our pleasure to have you on. How serious is this going to get? Gerald Celente, the trends forecaster who drops in on me from time to time, as you do, he's been forecasting for the last couple of years that this is building up into something that's going to be very, very serious. Are we at the beginning of something that is going to lead ultimately to a conflict, a military conflict between the US, Israel, and other actors in the region and Iran? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I haven't heard any other commentator link the North Korea story to the Iran story, because we've seen, haven't we, over the last few days, the amazing rapprochement, apparently via Twitter, between Trump and Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
And, you know, Trump stepping into North Korea. I would suggest there's a sinister angle towards this, in that the US foreign policy people, and by the way, that's Jared Kushner and Mike Pompeo. There was a fascinating article the other day from Rex Tillerson, who used to be the boss of Exxon, who was Trump's first Secretary of State, who was then replaced, because he apparently had been moaning to Trump, saying, well, Jared Kushner keeps interfering in my foreign policy. So he was sacked and Pompeo was brought in. But apparently, this is what Tillerson has said, is that Jared Kushner was running his own foreign policy and Tillerson wasn't allowed to do anything about it. And of course, Kushner is really the voice of Netanyahu in US politics. So I think what's going on here with North Korea is that the whole North Korea thing is being put on hold. Let's cool down in North Korea and let's focus on getting a war going with Iran. And I think they're actually serious about this. I really do.
You really do see that. It's interesting you say that, because over the weekend, Fox News presenter Tucker Carlson, who's a very different type of presenter than the one you'd ordinarily expect to come across on Fox, he's very much anti-war. He's very much anti US hegemony in the world and in the Middle East. And he interviewed Trump, and he pressed Trump as much as you'd expect a Fox News anchor to press him on it. And Trump was talking up the fact that he hadn't responded to the drone coming down. He also, has seemingly marginalised the lunatic hawk John Bolton in recent days. So some of our listeners might think, well, let's give Trump the benefit of the doubt for now. At least this week, he's been saying and doing the right things, Tony. Re-Iran.
How long can he keep it up? This is the trouble. He's circling. He's almost like a cowboy being circled by Indians. All the time, he's under more and more pressure. And of course, there's this FBI prosecution as well, which is putting him under pressure. I mean, I just think eventually he's going to be bullied into doing what he's being told to do. It's the arms industry and it's the Zionist lobby that are pushing for this, because the arms industry stands to make an absolute fortune out of any kind of conflict. And it seems pretty obvious to me that the tension is, is being ramped up and up. Each time we see some sort of conflict in the Gulf, whether it's a drone or one of the tankers or a pumping station that's hit or an airport that's hit,
oh, we've lost
by the Houthis or whatever side it happens to be, it seems to be getting more tense each time or more dangerous each time. I mean, just look at the state of the tankers a few weeks ago. You know, you've got one of the tankers just had a hole in the side of it, but the other one was the whole of the side of the tanker had been burning, you know, so it seems to me that the idea is each time there is a provocation in the Gulf, whether it's the Persian Gulf or the Gulf of Oman or the Straits of Hormuz itself, which is in between the two, it is getting worse and it's getting more serious. So I don't think they're going to give up on this, Richie.
No, they won't. Here's a question for you. I've got to bring in the Labour Party. Some front bench members of the Labour Party, including the leader himself, have had very close ties to the Stop the War coalition over the years. You and I both know many people who have worked tirelessly for the Stop the War coalition. And yet, on the Iranian question, there's been a deafening silence from the Labour Party front bench. Is that because they've got other fish to fry, namely Brexit, namely anti-Semitism allegations? What do you think?
Well, really good question. There's lots of stuff that the Labour Party, as an opposition party, should be saying. And let me tell you this absolutely for certain. People like Chris Williamson and people like Ken Livingstone, were they still in the Labour Party? And neither of them are anymore because they've both been booted out or suspended. They would be saying all sorts of things on these issues, but it looks as if that's one of the reasons why they've been kicked out.
Well, that's very interesting. So you believe that the people, the architects of a war with Iran, they play a very long game, even clever enough to remove the vocal opposition to it well in advance, Tony. Is that what you think?
Well, look, I mean, we know for a fact, an absolute fact, that the Israeli embassy, through Shai Massot, who was their political attaché, had offered £1 million to infiltrate the Labour Party for the benefit of the Israeli foreign ministry. Now, that seems to me to be absolutely exactly what most embassies do. Most of the time around the world, political attachés in these embassies and military attachés have a similar sort of role. But the only thing is, this time it was recorded by Al Jazeera, by no means perfect channel, but it just shows how appalling our media is in Britain, that we have to leave it to the Qatari state broadcaster to dish the dirt on these people.
It's horrible as well. I did a broadcast last week where I specifically focused on the pretty dark career of Dame Margaret Hodge. Now, you know, there are those who would say it's pretty cheap to be dragging up the past in that way, but because Hodge is the witchfinder general in terms of trying to out people as anti-Semitic, it's very important to point out as often as we can, because the mainstream media is ignoring it, that Margaret Hodge deliberately covered up paedophilia going on in Islington when she was leader of Islington Council. And not only that, but she had to pay one of the victims compensation after sending him a letter basically calling him a deranged individual. This is a horrible person. And this sort of stuff is relevant, Tony, when Hodge is calling everybody in sundry anti-Semitic, right?
Well, there's another aspect to Hodge as well, is that she, as a Labour Party person, supposedly, one does, you know, wonder whether she's just kind of infiltrating the Labour Party to disrupt it. She's also failing to pay tax. She's got loads of... there's a brilliant article just a couple of days ago. I can't remember which of the mainstream websites or national newspapers is, explaining how she does her tax avoidance. I mean, she has a massive amount of wealth and loads of companies, but she pays virtually no tax at all on those things. So these are the sorts of things you'd expect, you know, the Daily Mirror, etc., to be exposing, but nobody seems to be doing that, Richie.
Nobody's doing it, no. Of course, Margaret Hodge is an Oppenheimer. She's worth untold, unimaginable amounts of money. And the fact that she's avoiding paying taxes in this country, the fact that she was found to be covering up, and she was covering it up that's not, it's not that she didn't know about it. She knew about it and chose to cover it up in Islington. This is a pretty vile individual. Tony Gosling has stopped on his travels to speak to us today. We're very grateful to Tony for that. Thisweek.org.uk. The politics show on BCFM is unmissable. There's nothing like it on radio in the UK today. There isn't. It's a terrific programme. Let me ask you this, my friend.
Listen, hang on, Richie, because you do a similar thing to what we do, which no, very, very, very few people do, and the broadcasters should be doing this, and that is to be doing world news coverage and national news coverage from the regions and from outside London. Almost everything is focused in London. I mean, for many years, the Guardian newspaper was based in Manchester, and they were doing world news coverage, they were doing national news coverage from Manchester, but then they moved to London. And for example, in Bristol, we have massive ethnic communities from all over the world. You know, enormous West Indian, Somali. I mean, you know, there's a list as long as your arm. So why not, and, you know, as we do from time to time, when there's something to say, for example, about Sudan, why do you need to be in London? No, we talk to the Sudanese or the Somali Bristol community and get the word out from the regions. You know, so this is one of the things I think is part of the propaganda media model we're looking at in Britain. It's focusing everything in London. It's much easier to control like that, and that's why that mould needs to be broken.
It does indeed. There's a couple of big stories this week that are worth talking about. The culture, the Digital Media and Culture Committee finished their consultation on the online harms white paper, which they published a few weeks ago. The consultation finished the day before yesterday. The news media collectively has come out and said that it's a terrifying thing, this online harms white paper, and it's ultimately going to have a devastating effect for free speech on the internet, Tony. You're obviously worried about this, and you're thinking about this as well.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, this is one way, isn't it, to, you know, to censor the internet, to get rid of all the wonderful opportunities that there have been to share information. I mean, I think one of the reasons the internet has exploded as it has is as it came along. I compare it really to the golden age of television. So we're talking about the 1960s and 70s, particularly fantastic TV, all sorts of brilliant creative stuff, brave, courageous material, gripping, you know, engaging. And that was closed down, I think, really in the 1980s and the 1990s. We're seeing a similar sort of thing happening with the internet now, I think. So we've had the noughties of most of this last decade of the golden age of the internet. Everyone's been driven quite obviously onto platforms of social media and to the tech giant platforms like Google in order to get any kind of decent coverage, because the mainstream media has become so bland, so propagandistic. And now those tech giants are starting to be closed down too. So in other words, if you want to post the truth on Facebook, you will often find a little notice comes up and says, sorry, this post has breached the community guidelines, this sort of thing. So you simply cannot use these, in many cases, you cannot use these tech giants to share the truth anymore, Richie. So that's the way I look at this. It's just another way of closing the internet down, saying that, oh, this is causing harm, etc. Of course, in the meantime, there's fantastic amounts of pornography allowed and available on the internet, and we know now that much of the pornography is viewed by, you know, boys of around 11, 12, 13 years old. That doesn't really seem to bother them so much, and that's one of the things that this online harms legislation is supposed to do something about. But is it going to? Who knows? I think the main reason for it, I agree with you, is the main reason for it is to start shutting down good alternative sources for news. Because the mainstream is just appalling with news nowadays. It's so, I mean, there's all these demonized states like the Iranians, like the Russians. A lot of people really take seriously this idea that Russia is now a fascist country and Putin is like Hitler. You know, I mean, even had Prince Charles calling Putin Hitler. You know, this is the sort of madness, I think, which is designed to herd people towards the situation where a war suddenly becomes a reasonable proposition.
You're right, Tony. The anti-Russian stuff is relentless. There are stories emerging today again about doping in Russian athletics. It's just relentless. It never stops. On a final word on the online harms thing, we can maybe then talk just a little bit about Hong Kong. Love to get your thoughts on that. But before...
I also want to get in some stuff about these European appointments.
Oh, yeah, of course. Huge story, of course, but we're going to get into that anyway. But the regulator, once this online harms stuff becomes law, the regulator, which will either be the existing regulator or a new regulator, would effectively have the power, I mean, the most powerful regulator in the world, to decide what constitutes harm and what doesn't, and can have stuff struck down or struck off the internet, even if it isn't against the law of the land. It's terrifying stuff, this. And it's coming in. It's not even speculation, this is coming in. Before we talk about the madness of the anti-democratic European Union, I look at the Hong Kong situation, the protests that have been going on for weeks. Apparently they began about extradition, but they're more about democracy and more besides, I think. Could it be that what we are seeing in Hong Kong is, on the face of it, pretty much what we are seeing? I know that's a very badly phrased question, but there are a number of people saying there's a conspiratorial element to the students protesting. There are actors outside of China, outside of Hong Kong, trying to influence things there. Couldn't it just be that the truth is that in Hong Kong they've had enough of the encroachment of the Chinese government? They've had enough of the Chinese government kind of reneging on the one country, two systems plan. Could it just be as we see it, Tony?
Okay, so these protests have been incredibly massive. In other words, between millions of people turning out on the street and incredibly well organized. I mean, I don't think that's just the CIA or MI6 helping with the organization necessarily. I think Hong Kong people for decades now have been seriously worried about whether, they're going to get the same kind of laws imposed in China. One thing I would say as a caveat, though, is the Chinese, I believe, are doing this for a specific reason. And that specific reason is the arrest of the Huawei finance officer in Canada and the extradition threat of her to the United States. So I think that's one of the reasons why the Chinese are now imposing this.
Very interesting.
Nobody seems to really have recognized that. So since we've got a Chinese citizen about to be extradited to the US from Canada, the Chinese seem to be saying, well, if you can do that, so can we. And that's, I think, the main cause of what's happening now with this new legislation in Hong Kong. So what the Chinese are doing is not just all on its own. It's a reaction to something specific that the West is doing, which is, particularly pernicious. So anyway, but having been to Hong Kong myself about 18 months ago and spent a couple of weeks there, and one of the most fascinating places, Richie, is something called the Foreign Correspondents Club, where you get cheap drink and cheap meals and also fascinating conversation with foreign correspondents who've been working in the region, the whole of Asia, really, including Australasia, etc., for 30, 40 years, is that they don't believe that China is strong enough to totally change Hong Kong.
Very
they actually believe that the other way round is more necessary, that China will become more like Hong Kong. And I said to these correspondents, surely this is just Western propaganda. They say the trouble is that actually Hong Kong works really, really well, and the people who live in China around Hong Kong know this, and there's no way that the Chinese government are going to be able to impose a China-like authoritarian system where there isn't any real freedom of speech on Hong Kong. So this is a tension that is coming along, and I honestly do not know whether the David or the Goliath in this situation is going to win the day.
Very interesting, Tony. Let's talk about the European Union. The Parliament reconvened the day before yesterday, Monday, of course. The Brexit Party wouldn't acknowledge Ode to Joy, the European National Anthem, all sorts of funny things going on. But most importantly, it's going to get its first female commission president, it looks like it now. That's very interesting. A woman called Ursula von der Leyen, and the Italian socialist will be the new head of the European Parliament, a guy called David Maria Sassoli. What's very interesting about the last couple of days of kind of manoeuvring in Brussels and in Strasbourg is that it should be even more clear to anybody than maybe it was before just how completely anti-democratic the whole European project is. What have you made of Ursula von der Leyen, the whole election process for the Commission President and all the rest of it? What are your thoughts?
Okay, well, first of all, just on the pronunciation, it's Ursula von der Leyen.
Von der Leyen, which I suppose is ironic.
Von der Leyen. Or von der Leyeness, maybe we should call her.
Yeah.
But look, okay, so the reason I know how to pronounce her name is because I was taught it over in Germany by the Bilderberg attendees in 2016.
She was at Bilderberg.
The Bilderberg meeting in Dresden. One of the things that came out of that meeting was that it was the second year, and these were rumours that came from the hotel, it was the second year in a row where von der Leyen had been sitting next to Henry Kissinger at the top table on the Saturday evening's Bilderberg evening meal. And we've been scratching our heads ever since, Richie.
Who is she?
Thinking, well, what is she,
yeah.
Is she going to make, well, she was the defence minister at the time, is she going to make it to become the replacement for Merkel? Surely. You know, if Kissinger and the Bilderbergers are tapping her up to be a European leader, as they always do. And I was absolutely gobsmacked to hear yesterday, wow, von der Leyen could be taking over as the Commission President. Now, one of the things that she's been doing, and she's been spearheading as German Defence Minister, is the integration of all the EU armed forces. So she's been spearheading that programme, and I think that she's been put in charge is because that is her main task. She will, over the next few years, be bringing all the militaries of the EU countries under one command. And that's her job. And, of course, that command will be essentially NATO command, because NATO are based in Brussels too. So that's my reading of her being put in charge of the nearly billion population.
She's going to oversee military she's going to oversee military unification, Tony.
I honestly think that's why. And I was really amazed that she wasn't taking on a bigger role in German politics, you know, or in some other European role of one sort or another. But to now hear that she's going to be the top dog, appointed, never elected by anybody, appointed by the Bilderbergers, by Kissinger, by, you know, the global financial elite in the Western world to run the United States of Europe, that actually now the penny's dropped. It doesn't come as such a great surprise at all.
It's very interesting. Yesterday afternoon, you may not have seen it, but Sky News had a number of MEPs speaking live from Strasbourg, and a number of them kept referring to the national anthem, which is a bit of a Freudian slip, and they were corrected several times. Like the Brexit Party guys were there, and they were saying, listen, it's not a national anthem, it's a European anthem. But it's amazing, the thinking of the political class in the UK is that this is a nation-state project. This is going to be, as you described it, the United States of Europe, and that's that. It's quite remarkable, really. And Jeremy Corbyn, by the way, and I love you, mate, we've been speaking for years, me and you, but I love to bash Jeremy every now and then when you're on the programme. Corbyn, of course... I know you're not a supporter of any politician. Corbyn today, actually did, at Prime Minister's questions, throw the gauntlet down and asked for a second referendum. The faux socialist, the Social Democrat Jeremy Corbyn. So Labour, he's capitulated now to the Blairites in his own party and the Europhiles, and he's now towing the line and asking for a second referendum. We're never going to leave, Tony. Never.
Well, hang on, because the Conservatives are in charge at the moment, just about. So yeah. They may bring us out. They may just about still, even though there's a lot of people saying that they can't still. I take you back to, I think we've had this conversation before, it's a fascinating article by Karl von Habsburg, the leader of the Pan-European Union, which was begun in 1923, I think it was, before even the Nazi Party was formed in Munich, in the same city. And he is saying that the Brexit is a reality TV show. These are literally the Holy Roman Emperors of the past, who are now an aristocracy, a massive landowning and capital-controlling aristocracy, who are sitting behind the scenes. You'll never see them on television. talking about anything at all, because, but nevertheless, they are the owners of Europe. They're the owners of the place. They're not politicians, per se, but they are deciding what's actually going on. But then we've got to also mention Christine Lagarde taking over as the head of the European Central Bank, because isn't that fascinating too? She is a convicted criminal. Convicted financial criminal. Back in 2008, she stole £350 million and gave it in France to one of Sarkozy's financial backers, and she was taken to court in France 2 years ago and prosecuted and convicted. But then, guess what?
No punishment.
The whole thing was overturned. Unbelievable, really. And she was told that even though she was facing a year in prison for that, no, it's okay. You don't have to go to prison, Christine Lagarde, because we've got another job for you. It's head of the European Central Bank. So you've now got a convicted financial criminal who should have done at least a year in prison running the whole of the Eurozone, which is governing the finances of something like 800 million people across the EU Eurozone.
You're absolutely right. And for listeners who are new to that information, they shouldn't be, because Tony Gosling back in 2016 was talking about this. I was talking about this. Just Google Lagarde guilty of government payout and massive government payout, and you'll see that. A convicted criminal running the European Central Bank. These are.
I should say also, Christine Lagarde has been a tender at Bilderberg meeting.
For years.
You know, yeah. I'm not saying, by the way, that Bilderberg is the top of global capitalism in the West, generally. I mean, there occasionally are Chinese involved in this, the big Chinese banks as well, for example. But they are certainly the main political lobby of Europe, of global financial capitalism. So they are, the Bilderberg conference is where you'll see all the leaders come along before they actually become the leaders of Europe, before they become prime ministers, presidents, that sort of thing. They're always tapped up at Bilderberg. It's like a kind of horse trading session where the people that own most of the West money in the Western world get a chance to say, oh, this is the next big politician. So, you know, some of the small fry, they may not go to Bilderberg because they don't have much power over our futures. But those, I mean, just think also, by the way, about what's happened with Catalonia.
Yes.
I mean, the Catalan leader has been elected as an EU MEP, but he's been refused the opportunity to actually take up his seat. So, you know, the EU is only interested in centralising power in its own hands.
Of course,
you know,
it is.
There's no real democracy involved there whatsoever.
No, I can't argue with any of that. I can't, even though maybe
now,
I should sometimes.
I mean, about 5G, by the way.
Yeah, just before you do, you know, go ahead. Yeah, because I did speak about this at the top of the program. It's been switched on in 7 cities today, including Manchester. No health impact study. Potentially devastating. Go ahead, Tony.
Apparently it's coming on in Bristol today. Vodafone are running 5G in Bristol. I'm not sure if they've switched it on. No idea. But I had a chat, an interesting chat, with the Green Group leader, Ursula Cumley, in Bristol. And it's a big Green contingent on the city council. Looks like we may well get the second Green MP in the next general election in Bristol, because the Labour Party have been so hopeless under the Mayor Marvin Rees there. And she's a physicist. So I spoke to her on the phone. I said, can you come on the radio, it's Eleanor, to talk about 5G, to explain this, the health effects, you know, and also how green it is or how not green it is, because of course it's taking massive amounts more energy to use this system. And she's a physicist. I thought she'd be keen to do that. But no.
No.
The Greens are very worried about talking about 5G for one reason, and that is that the EU is in charge of regulating all this, and the EU has completely failed to regulate it by putting all of the telecoms companies in charge of the regulation.
That's right.
So it's a very interesting thing, but the Greens to talk about, or any pro-EU people to talk about, that it's actually a complete failure of regulation by Brussels.
I've had somebody on the programme that you know very well. I've had him on a couple of times in the last few weeks talking about this, Chris Busby. I've had Chris on, I've had Barry Trower on, of course, but Chris Busby, this is going to be a global killer, this. And look,
I learned recently about 5G, and you may have covered this yourself, but It's a very, it's a low frequency and high frequency too. So the high frequencies of 5G are actually higher frequency than radar. Now we all know how damaging the radar frequencies have been. They covered up in World War II, but this is the, these are the high, you know, power microwaves and high frequency microwaves that 5G is letting out. But the trouble is those high frequency waves find it difficult to get into people's homes. So they have a low frequency contingent which gets through the walls and into your house. This is really a pernicious technology which is designed to penetrate our lives at every level possible, Richie.
Tony, it's disgusting. We'll talk about 5G again in the near future, you and me. Before we go today, thanks for stepping off the motorway today to chat with us, by the way. It means a lot to me, mate. No matter what I ever put to you about whatever subject, you're always well briefed. You've always got a good answer. It's an amazing thing, really. Not too many around like you. But by the time we speak again, there will be a new Prime Minister. Who will it be? Will it be Johnson? Will it be Hunt? Does it even matter, Tony?
Well, yes, it does matter, because Hunt is just another Remainer. But the idea is really, I mean, look at William Hill. Yeah? Look at the bookies' money is all on Boris. And they're quite good at getting it right. So I imagine it will be Boris. But then that's because Boris is easily manipulated. We've got an interview with Ken Livingstone. We're using an exclusive on Friday where I can just leak to you. Ken says basically, because I thought he's the best person to talk to about Boris having been beaten by him in London. And he says, well, Boris isn't actually a politician. He's just a wannabe celebrity. He's only interested in the limelight, you know, the cameras, the lights, being in the studio, being in the centre of attention. And of course, that means that although he may become Prime Minister, he's going to be an absolutely hopeless Prime Minister because all he's interested in his own narcissistic self-attention. And, you know, he will not be able to deal with any of these issues like we were talking about Iran and the nuclear option. You know, the idea that is Iran enriching uranium? He hasn't got his head around any of this at all. In fact, I mean, none of the Western press has really explained that the Iranians have been enriching uranium to 3 2/3%. Which is really very, very minimal. You need 90% enriched uranium to actually make a nuclear weapon. And none of the media in the West has explained that. They're saying, oh, the Iranians are enriching uranium. This is exactly the sort of nonsense that Boris will not be able to get to grips with. And so that's what makes him a hopeless leader, even though he may be more pro-Brexit than Jeremy Hunt.
We're going to wait and see. Tony, thanks for doing it today. Thisweek.org.uk, The Politics Show with Tony Gosling on BCFM. Check it out. Follow Tony on Twitter as well. There's only one Tony Gosling. Thanks, mate. Let's do it again in a few weeks. Thanks for your help, Tony.
God bless, Richie. Thanks very much for asking me on.
You too. Will you stop? It's an absolute honour, mate. Thanks. The brilliant Tony Gosling there, live on the line from one of the UK's motorways. He's driving today, Tony, and stepped off the motorway to have a chat with us. Great guy. Thisweek.org.uk.